once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of the second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Wait, we did that so well.
We did that really, really well.
You know, if we practice at that another, 14 years or so, we might really get good at it.
Maybe.
Well, we'll keep working on it.
Some problems with that. I mean, we've already practiced this long, and it's been, since 98, so we're talking about 18 years, so...
Yeah, well, you're catching up.
We may be good at this eventually.
But see, you're catching up with me on your age, so we'll eventually be approximately the same age.
I wanted to
hit... If I live long enough.
One last piece from the caller last hour. If you don't mind.
Okay, but let's just say this is the Personal Wealth Coach.
Yes.
And presuming that today is Saturday the 26th of November 2016, you can give us a call at 773-1400, area code 254.
254-773-1400.
Or not, as the case may be.
Right.
All right, go ahead.
All right. There was a time that I would consider myself open-minded about human-caused global warming.
So now you're closed-minded?
I am. I've come to a conclusion that I believe, unless somebody can provide me better evidence, which is going to be really hard, that the evidence points really hard in one direction. So let me cover that. We look around.
Ooh, he's going to keep us in suspense.
Which way? When we look at, this is an area that old Baldy over here is really great at. He loves stargazing. He is an astrophotographer. He can look up at the sky. And he can tell huge nebula, and he knows what they're made of, what gases are in there. Can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
The primary gas in the universe is hydrogen. Everything starts as hydrogen, and hydrogen does a really, really good
job
doing certain things.
How do we know that?
How do we know that? Well, because of basic physics, for one thing. And the other thing is, we figured out, because of the stuff that's coming off of the sun, that the sun is basically burning hydrogen.
Right.
And we also know that there's a gigantic cloud of hydrogen that stops the that's up there in the sky that stops the radiation and heat from the center of the galaxy from cooking us. So hydrogen is really good at blocking lower frequency radiation like infrared.
Okay. That blocking ability that hydrogen has, we can look up there and measure it to know that it's hydrogen doing it, because hydrogen blocks certain radiations. It reflects others. Following?
Right.
Okay.
We're going to get to carbon here in a minute.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
We do the same thing when we're mining for minerals. When you take a sample from a mine and you take it to a spectrometer, it blows up a very, very, very tiny piece of that sample with a laser and then looks at the cloud that comes off of it and can identify that cloud by what radiates off of it and what reflects from it. So this is stuff that goes back to Newton. When Newton was looking at the stars and using things to make rainbows out of them, and there's a lot of different refraction techniques that can do it, but a prism is a very simple one. Crystals are great. You can make rainbows out of it, and you can look at the size of the color on that rainbow. That's why it's called a spectrometer, by the way, because it's the spectrum of colors. That spectrum of colors can tell us what are in the minerals in our planet, and what's being burned in the stars above us, and what the gases are up there.
Right.
And when we use that technique on our planet, we're seeing that heat is being captured in our atmosphere by CO2.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt in my mind that the CO2 comes from human production. The reason why is because we can watch how much we're doing, and we're putting more CO2 into the atmosphere than is being absorbed by plants. Volcanoes have a big part of that. Yeah, they put some out there. We're doing more than the volcanoes now, and that's measurable.
Right.
Which means that the evidence is there that we're creating CO2, which is a greenhouse gas. Okay, so theory should say, well, we're going to get warmer. Spectrometer research shows that the heat is being encapsulated in the CO2 in our atmosphere. So there's evidence.
Reflected back by the CO2.
Reflected down into the planet and held as a greenhouse would. So the theory says it. The science on the other end says it. That means that unless somebody can show me how that's wrong, I have to believe that humans are at least a major contributor to global warming.
I could add something to that. Number one, there's a lot, since we've got space technology, we can take a look at things like the northern polar ice cap from, the mid-1980s forward, very, very clearly, not measuring it on the ground where it changes from one year to the next. We can see that in the summertime, and even right now, there is a lot less ice in the Arctic regions, and the glaciers across the world are shrinking. And worse, this is the thing that's frankly a little bit scary to me, is the shrinkage of ice around the South Pole.
Mm-hmm.
And they're isolated places where it's gotten colder at the center of the North Pole. It's getting colder, for instance, during the winter in New England, but there's really good reasons for that. But this is the point. Global warming has actually been going on for several tens of thousands of years. The Romans lived in a much colder environment than we do today.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't cause global warming.
We're just making it faster.
We're accelerating it. And frankly, the problem with accelerating it is nature doesn't move in a straight line. It's going to kind of coast along for a while, and there's a big ice shelf in Antarctica that's got me a little bit concerned. Because
there's one in Greenland as well.
But there's the big shelf. There's this huge shelf of ice in Antarctica that up until very recently went all the way to the bottom of the ocean and didn't have warm water, relatively warm. Water, by definition, that's circulating under it
is not frozen,
so it's warmer. And now it's got a lot of water under it. And the thing about ice, once it gets water under it that's above freezing temperature,
it melts.
It eventually is going to float that ice. And when it floats that ice, it'll break. And when it breaks loose, it's going to go into the ocean, and it's going to start north, and it's going to start melting. And the thing is, a lot of the other stuff that's going on is going to happen fairly slowly and very gradually, and we can kind of get used to it. But that one particular ice shelf by itself, and you're going to think it's a little crazy, has the potential to raise the ocean 18 inches. And that is one of those mind-boggling events. If you look at the percentage of the United States then will be underwater, that's a little bit scary.
There's another piece here, and this is a piece that's the good news side of it. If you look at the CO2 emissions in the United States in 2005 and in 2015, we're 15% lower in our emissions.
Mm-hmm.
But the developing world, not the developed world, the developing world passed us last year. The developed world now produces a lot less CO2 than the developing world,
right.
And that happened and it's going to increase dramatically from here on. So bringing China and India on board to say, hey, this is really bad.
Well,
because we're already limiting. Our economy is limiting our CO2 emissions. And as we mm-hmm. said with the recycling, and usually when it's good for the economy, it's good for the ecology too. Not always. When you're talking about power plants, that's not true. But when I talk about recycling, it is.
It's fascinating that with the election of Donald Trump, one of the things that the premier of China said is that we want to hold to the agreements that we have with the United States on reducing our carbon emission. Now, why? Did they suddenly become environmentalists? No.
No.
They just have recognized that if they don't fix things, their economy and country will be wrecked. And the new Indian prime minister, I don't know if it's president or prime minister there. Anyway, he also is recognizing
Modi.
That pollution is costing him more than it's actually costing their economy more than reducing pollution would. And as a result, there is this awakening in the world economically that says
Prime Minister,
that says, hey, you're right. We need to reduce, even Indonesia, where they have these huge fires each year where they burn off great quantities of forest for the purpose of growing a different kind of agricultural trees, is beginning to recognize that this is not going to be good behavior. The only problem is in Indonesia is they don't have enough control over who does what there to effectively stop it. But they're beginning to get the message around the world. And frankly, it's economics. It's basically economics.
Very much so.
If we can educate people that producing less carbon dioxide and less pollutant in the air is better for them economically than producing more, and that's a true statement, the world will turn around very nicely. I don't particularly like the idea of labeling carbon dioxide that you breathe out as a pollutant.
No, no.
I think that's excessive, but I think recognizing that we do need to assist Texas, by the way, one of the more conservative states in the United States, has the fastest growing renewable energy source state in the United States.
For good reason, because we're an energy state. And when we can look at something economically, this is something that I've said for many, many years. The government can try to step in and set the rules and say, you can't produce this, you can't produce that, you got to produce these, or you got to play with these monopoly money carbon credit things. The reality is that the marketplace has to drive this. We have to get to a point where we recognize that it's a lot more cost effective to treat the economy correctly. We did it in the 1970s with the Clean Air Act. I mean, nobody likes to watch a river going through your
Clean Water
Act. Clean Water Act. I'm sorry. Yeah, it's Clean Water Act. Nobody wants to watch a river going through your backyard be on fire for months.
Particularly when you didn't have a river in your backyard before.
Right. That's a problem. So we can recognize that things that we do are bad, and that if somebody, and this is another one, Alaska is one of the most conservative states. They have clean water regulations. When somebody's mining for gold just to keep the silt out of the water, because that kills the fish. And the fish are one of the reasons why tourists come to Alaska. If you kill the fish, tourists stop coming, you get less money.
So you're saying tourism is good for the economy?
It is.
And good for the ecology?
It is. And as long as it's done properly.
So we should all go to Europe because the dollar is almost on parity with the euro? And
yeah, we should. We should go be tourists and check it out, and when our dollar is doing well, and you know, we can be loud and in everybody's face like like we do as Americans. But it's our right to do that. And I tend to think that economics should drive the ecological shift. When we realize it's in our best interest to do something, we do it really well. When the government just comes in and arbitrarily says, no, don't do that, without good explanation, that doesn't work. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work in Indonesia, and it really doesn't work in the United States. We're some independent-minded people here. That's why we're so productive and so creative, is because we're looking for better ways to do what we already do. We're looking for ways to make more money doing what we already do.
I actually have something I want to talk about that's going to take a little bit, so we might want to run our first commercial break.
Okay. Well, that's a good idea. We can do that. It's the right time to do it anyway.
Good.
Not that we ever do it at the right time, but
let's just break some. Let's be Trump-like and break all the rules.
Right.
Okay?
Here we go. So if you'd like to call us during the break or after, the number in here to call is 254-773-1400. This is the Personal Wealth Coach with
Jeff
and Jake McClure, and we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Hey, out there, folks. Telephone number is near, still 773-1400. Area code's 254, so that's 254-773-1400. This is Jeff, and I want to talk about something, and we're going to bring it up here. A couple of the Obama administration rules look like they're about to get rolled back. One of them is the wage adjustment overtime rule, which just tore up businesses from one the country to the other.
It certainly had an impact on our business.
And we got a stay from a federal court, I think, on Friday.
It was earlier in the week. I think it was Tuesday.
And all the Trump administration has to do to kill that rule, by the way, is just not defend it in court. But there's another one out there that looks like it's going to die, that probably deserves to die, but it was with good intent, it was set up, and it's something I think you really need to understand. We've already had some people that we've talked to that didn't understand what it was about, and it's called the fiduciary rule. And I've talked to people who are very well educated who don't know the meaning of the word fiduciary. But if you're going, in our society where
let's tell them the definition.
I'm
before
going to.
We can, all right. Go
I'm
ahead.
Going to. Okay. The point is that in our society, more and more and more, you're going to be required to handle your finances and your investments and your retirement accounts and so on, without the nanny government looking over your shoulder to try to protect you. That's just a reality. It's been there all along. You're just becoming aware of it. Now, there are basically two categories of people who call themselves advisors, financial advisors, investment advisors, whatever. There's two categories of people. The people who call themselves financial advisors are salespeople. It's an unregulated term. It means that I'm going to sell you something. By definition, it may not be in your best interest because I'm going to sell it to you, and I'm not going to tell you how much you're going to earn. I'm not going to tell you how much anybody else earns on this or whether it's even very good for you. As a matter of fact, the salesperson who speaks to you about a financial product may be completely convinced it is in your best interest when that person simply doesn't know. The other side is the investment advisor. And the investment advisor, and here's the word, is required to be a fiduciary if they're a full-time investment advisor. Now, if they're a part-time investment advisor, they can switch out. What's fiduciary mean? It means a person who is required to act in your best interest at all times. And if there is a conflict of interest between your best interest and his or her best interest, to tell you in writing clearly what that is and allow you to take it into account. They're supposed to avoid them as much as possible, and in the case of what's called ERISA, which is a retirement account, they do have to avoid them completely. But even if you talk to an investment advisor as opposed to a financial advisor, and they have a conflict of interest, in other words, I'm going to earn a bunch of money if you buy this, they have to tell you how much they're going to earn. Now, in reality, if you go with what's called a fee-only investment advisor, you're going to find an organization that, because they call themselves fee only, are in the position where they've pretty much banished the idea of hidden under the table kickbacks. If you go with any other type of person who is selling financial stuff that's not willing to say, I am a full-time fiduciary, that's the key word, it has a legal meaning. That puts them under a federal law and makes them liable if they violate it. You're going to be in a position where they are selling you something that may be really, really, really bad for you and really, really, really good for them and their employer. And in many cases, this is probably the worst part about it. They can be completely sincere in saying this is good because they don't know how bad it is. So it's kind of like if you went to a car dealership, you can tell the difference between a new car and a used car readily. You can look at the blue book and you can say, here's a fair price for the car. If you want to look it up, you can figure it out. But there's absolutely no question when you go to a car dealership that the salesperson is working for the car dealership and working to get their commission and working to make as much money as they can for the car dealership. They are not your employee. They are not a person you are paying to work for them. That's the way most of the financial industry works. The other side of the financial industry is there are some people out there, and our firm happens to be one of those groups of people, that work exclusively for their clients. And you get to see how much it costs when you buy something. You get gory details of how much it costs, which may not make you happy, but it's reality. And in most cases, it will make you happy because, by definition, an investment advisor, a fiduciary, is required to find the lowest cost for something when they offer it to you, unless it provides you with some benefits that justify the additional cost. Is that a good? Did I do it good?
Yeah, you did a great job there.
Okay, you want to add some more to that? You certainly can.
I mean, the very most basic concept here is whether the person is telling you how much they get paid in detail.
In writing.
If they say, here's where I get paid and how, that's one big chunk of it. If they claim to be a fiduciary, but across the board are not doing that, they may be a fiduciary in one area. So being aware of when somebody's working for you and when they're not, and to give a non-financial concept here, if you go to the doctor and the doctor tells you, or you find out somehow, that the doctor is being paid by the pharmaceutical companies. And then the doctor writes you a prescription.
Or a very expensive something.
Right. It makes it really hard to trust the doctor. Well, is he really doing this because it's in my best interest, or is he doing it because he's being paid by the pharmaceutical companies? Well, in Texas, it's illegal for doctors to receive direct compensation for writing prescriptions. It's illegal for doctors to own a pharmacy. It's not illegal for a chiropractor to do the same thing. A chiropractor can give you x-rays and a lot of other things and know full well that you may not need the x-ray, but wants to do it anyway, and they'll get paid for it. So there are some complexities here in understanding when someone is in your best interest and when they're not. And the first thing you should do is get in writing from them something saying that they're working in your best interest. That something saying clearly they're working in your best interest all the time or part of the time, and then clearly defining which part of the time they're not working in your best interest. And that's just one of those things that when I talk about this, people kind of zone out. It's really important. It's like going on eBay to buy a car. Hopefully the car exists. You may need to have some extra stuff going on. That's buyer beware. You can't really get eBay if they sell you a car that isn't even their own car. And I know this because I've had clients that bought cars on eBay that didn't exist or existed but weren't owned by the person selling them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right. I've run across that myself with trailers particularly.
Right. So the concept here is, in this case, somebody went on another car auction site, copied out an entire actual car listing, a real one, went over to eBay, and did their own listing for the same car. It had the same VIN. It had the same, all the things that you would go to check. He used all the information from that other auction, so it was all valid. It was outdated because the sale had already been made, and the person making this new sale didn't actually own the vehicle. Wow. We've got some sports teams going off in the other room. Anyway, we've got some more commercials that we're going to play. We'll be back on the other end with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join us in the meantime, you can call in at 254-773-1400. Hopefully we can go on to economics and what we're looking at for the future rather than dealing with physics and definitions of words. Hopefully we can make this a bit interesting. So we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
It's the 10th.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And telephone number in here is still 254. I almost
773.
Gave our office number. 254-773-1400. And I almost said 254-947-1111. You're welcome to call that, but we won't answer it. There's a voicemail there, and you'll hear somebody's melodious voice telling you we're not working today.
You're right, because it's Saturday.
Yes, and on the day dedicated to Saturn, we come here because of Saturnalia.
Yes, or something like that.
Yeah, so, okay. So, let's see, the overtime rule got put on. By the way, that is a plus to the economy.
Right, let's say what the overtime rule was. There was a big increase in the Obama administration said there are a lot of people that aren't getting paid for their time. They're getting salary instead, and that's an issue in that all the studies that came out about it, all the economists came out and said, well, that doesn't look like the area where people are hurting. But because Congress wouldn't do any of the other things that Obama wanted to have done, he wrote an executive order dealing with a law that currently on the books that allowed him to raise the lower level of income that could be considered salary, which you don't have to pay overtime for extra work and so on. And it had a horrible effect on businesses because the businesses either have to pay a lot more money to people who they thought were their most dedicated and most loyal people to keep them working there or give them a pay cut, because some of the requirements, the regulation in question was not written well. It was really not written well. It basically said that to keep a salary level that what you had before this change, you had to work 45 hours a week. 5 of those hours was overtime. Well, if you only work 40 hours, your employer is only allowed to pay you the 40 hours, which means you get a pay cut and you're doing the same job you were doing before, and they thought you were worth more than that before, but now the government's come in. It's complicated and silly.
And I think one of the reasons, well, there's a number of reasons, but I think the key to the win by Donald Trump was an overwhelming sense by a lot of people that there were people sitting in Washington on the East Coast who knew what was best for us in Texas,
and we
didn't know what was best for us in Texas.
Right, and that best for us in Texas included 9 reams of paper of new regulation for everyone to try to figure out how it affects them.
And
with no education from them on how it would affect us, just big penalties for not doing it right.
So for whatever it's worth, the good news, in a sense, if you're not in favor of all those rules and regulations, is that a couple of them, one of them just got stayed in federal court, and if the Trump administration does not defend it, it will die.
And that's the one that we just talked about, the one with the pay changes for overtime.
And there's some others, too. And unfortunately, there's a certain amount of baby going to go out with the bathwater and all of those. But
there is less baby than bathwater by far, though.
Yes, absolutely. One of the key things to remember here, one of the key things I think everybody really needs to get their mind around, is it's up to us. We have, in many cases, waited for the government to... We just assume, for example, if we buy something online, it's going to arrive.
Right.
And we've actually learned that that doesn't happen sometimes with other companies. My wife said the other day, I'm so used to Amazon, where if I order something from Amazon, it will arrive or they'll make it good. She ordered something from another company and then realized it wasn't going to work, and she canceled the order before they shipped it.
And she just still charged her for it.
And if you'll notice, if you walk into the house, there's a very large box. And so we're now waiting for them to pick it up.
How expensive is that box?
It's a very expensive box, and it is a microwave from another company. And it arrived after she canceled the order well before it was shipped, and recorded the cancellation, but they still shipped and charged anyway. And now it's been sitting there for over a week in our front hallway, waiting for somebody. They're arranging to have somebody pick it up, but it's happening so slowly, I'm beginning to wonder if it's going to get picked up. But that is just one example of the fact that we have come to trust that Big Brother is going to watch out for us. We, for instance, one of our favorite subjects is the 403Bs.
Yeah.
Which is what teachers and others have.
Well, there's
some of those.
403Bs for a hospital. Maybe perfectly great,
right.
But 403Bs for a lot of teachers in Texas are really, really ugly beasts.
And the thing is that 403Bs are largely unregulated, and as a result, we have seen some of the most, just horrifically bad investment products with fees and commissions on them that basically...
Eye-watering, to say the least.
It reminds me of what I once heard a financial guy say who sold those kinds of things, who actually created them to be sold, a CEO at the time. He actually said, what financial planning is the orderly conversion of your customers' money into your commissions and our profits.
That's not a good way to have an investment plan.
But there actually are financial products out there that are legal, that are licensed in the state of Texas, and that are in public school systems, for example, that we've seen where the fees exceed the return.
Greatly exceed the return.
But you don't know that because they hide the results for years and years and years. You really don't know that for a number of years. You just see it and they say, here's how much you paid for it and here's how much it's worth.
But if you ever go to liquidate it, you don't get that.
Unless you try to take the money. If you try to take the money, it's not there. And people don't understand that. And man, if I could change one thing, and I may, since we got a new
peace on earth.
No.
If I could change another thing, it would be all the children in the world. No, this is Saturday Night Live skit.
No.
This is a little bit old.
If I could change one thing in the massive bureaucracy that works around in our country right now, I would say, and it needs to be done at the state level, is there needs to be a serious education about investments and fees and expenses and economics that's given to every – it's as fundamental as learning how to read and write, because if you don't understand how investments work, you're assuming – that the government somehow will take care of it for you.
Right. And I heard somebody just a week ago tell me that he didn't know what I did, doesn't know what I do for a living. And he told me that he wouldn't approach the stock market. I mean, he tried that, and he lost a lot of money in the stock market. And that's the only thing that could happen in the stock market is you lose a lot of money. And somebody gets paid. And the reality is that that's true for some people. That there are completely legal situations where investing in the stock market will almost always lose you money and somebody else gets paid out of it. That's where doing your homework and understanding good investments from bad investments, and what does that even mean? Getting some level of understanding of what you're paying to be in a product. What the product means. If it's too complicated for you to understand it, you should not be in it, because it's not complicated enough for other people to understand it that made it. If it's too complicated to understand, somebody else is likely being paid. And that's kind of the bottom line here, is self-education, government education, whatever it is, the responsibility lies on your shoulders for your financial future. And if somebody told you, you know, next year you're going to have to switch a job, and we're not going to tell you what job you're going to be switched to, but you better learn about it when you get there, that would not be a comfortable situation. The same thing is true when the finances are going to be what pays you in retirement. You need to understand what's going on in there. You've got lots of time to get that understanding. But it lies on your shoulder. There's not a public school system for retirees that say, here's how to learn how to be retired.
But here's the problem with that. It's like saying, if you're not literate, you need to become literate.
Right.
But if you never got the basic education.
That's what I mean. It's falling on our listeners' shoulders, they're not getting any help.
And if you never got the basic education in understanding how an investment works and the difference between a long-term investment and short-term speculation, if you never got that education, then it's really hard to reach the point where you can educate yourself enough to understand it. And this is where a lot of people are taking a lot of advantage of other people. And in many cases, the people that are doing it don't know they're doing it. They don't understand.
They think they're doing something good. They believe it.
Right. They're selling something that gives them a good commission and a good living.
Just like if you've ever purchased something from a multi-level marketer. They believe in it.
Well, there's a certain irony to that.
Yes. It's very similar irony to that.
The irony is who just got named as Secretary of Education.
Right. Right.
or at least was the person who is named a Secretary of Education nominee to be, but not yet nominated. So the important thing is that I think a public education is in order. It's going to take a while to get there. I'm hoping that we reach the point where we can put it into the public school system so that 20 years from now people will be smarter. But right now it's not in the school system. And it's up to you as an individual, if you have investments, to understand what you have and understand the risks that are associated with it, and to understand that whoever it is that's offering you something to invest in or is running your investments, to understand how they get paid, and this is critical, how their company gets paid and how much exactly. And the only way to do that, in my opinion, is to ask the person you're dealing with to say, in writing, to actually put into writing that they will be a full-time fiduciary for you. Just put it in writing. Because what that does is it puts them in a position of having almost unlimited liability if they cheat. If they don't fulfill that and say, we're going to reveal everything to you, you're going to know the whole story and we're going to act in your best interest at all times.
And then if they don't do it.
If they don't, you can hang them in a tree. Because until they say they're full-time fiduciary.
You can't really do that. You can't hang them in a tree.
The law assumes that there's a commercial relationship. And in a commercial relationship, if you go to a car dealer, they don't have to tell you where all their fees and expenses are. They're not at all required to do that. They're just trying to, it's up to you. It's called buyer beware, caveat emptor. And the vast majority of the financial services world is caveat emptor. It's buyer beware. If you're not smart enough to figure out what's going on, that's too bad. It's an adversarial relationship between you and the salesperson. Now, the salesperson won't present it that way. I'm working for you. Well, I've heard car dealers say that, too.
Right. So, speaking of car dealers, this is a good segue. We're on track right now for the largest number of cars sold in a single year ever in the United States. All we have to do is stay flat without dropping for the next month. And we have more cars sold this year in the United States than ever before.
We forecast that, by the way.
We did. We did forecast that. And that's a big deal. Now, that doesn't mean that automakers are making a lot of profit. In fact, it's been the reverse, that they have been trying to change their lineup again. They're going back to SUVs. They're getting all those hybrid-type cars and keeping the concept, because people are still saying, what's the gas mileage? But the cars being sold are big cars again. Well, gas prices are down. Oil prices are down. Big car sales are out. Well, that means that there was a lot of retooling at the auto manufacturers. They had to change the lines to get the right cars made, and that means that their profits aren't as high. The good news is that we're spending it. The fact that they had to change the lines means that they had to pay people to change the lines. They got paid. They had to buy new equipment. That's great for the economy. Being nimble is not something the big companies are really good at, but when they do it, they pay a lot of money to do it, to get the cars that people want now, on the road now. That's really good news.
And I want to, you know, we're coming towards the end of the hour, and I did want to put something out there that to kind of summarize where we feel and perceive that this the market and the economy are, and that is that there's a strong parallel, at least this is Jeff. This is mine. I haven't discussed this with Jake directly, although I think he's going to agree with me. There's a strong parallel between the transition from Jimmy Carter to Ronald Reagan that's going on right now. And while it's certainly, as we've often said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. Mark Twain said that. What we're seeing is Donald Trump's election seems to have broken us, busted us out of an economic rut that we were in. And the economic rut can't be attributed to the president or to anyone else. It was a matter of the fact that there was a group of people in the House of Representatives, particularly, and to a lesser extent in the Senate, who were opposing what the president was doing, and the president was opposing what they wanted to do, so we were stuck. With everybody blocking everybody, and as a result, we had rules coming out of the, by the way, the rules that come out of the administration that during some of the political rhetoric, they said they were unconstitutional. They weren't really unconstitutional. The Constitution assigned the responsibility for a lot of those things to the Congress, but at various times, the Congress has passed laws delegating the responsibility for writing rules to the president. So the president could reinterpret the rules basically in the administration any way they wanted to. And if Congress really wanted to do something about that, they would simply repeal the law that delegated that authority to the president, which, of course, they don't want to do because that would involve them taking responsibility and doing a lot of work. And they have other things they would rather do. So what we have is a breaking out of the rut. What does that mean to you if you're an investor? It means get rid of your assumptions. And I'm old enough to remember the transition from the tax code and the economy that had developed after World War II was kind of changed a little bit by John F. Kennedy and then kind of ran out of steam under Jimmy Carter. And there was a reason in each case that we had those presidents, and it was Congress as much as the president, but we remember the presidents. The tax code was rewritten. The economy was kicked in the butt. The deficit went up dramatically. Spending went up dramatically. We headed off World War III, and we kicked our economy back into gear all at the same time. And symbolic of that to me was the Tax Reform Act of 1986, which the Reagan administration led into existence, crafted, gave to the Congress, and said, here's what we want. It changed our economy. Well, we're kind of running out of steam on the Tax Reform Act of 1986, at least partially, because the thing has been amended into non-existence. It looks an awful lot like the tax laws that we had prior to 1986, because this and that and the other and this raise in taxes here and this cut there and this other thing over here and this change, it's gradually morphed into a monster. The one thing I can say with some degree of confidence is business as usual is not going to be very usual in the near future. So make your assumptions based on the fact that we may see some major change in the governmental rules and in the way the economy functions if you compare it to the last 8 or 10 or 15 years. Just kind of get used to that. Don't make any assumptions. And also recognize, this is the one of the great ironies, and I'm just going on and on here, but one of the great ironies is, for those of you who understand economics at all, the conservatives in the Republican Party have historically been anti-Keynes.
Yeah, as in Keynes, the economist.
In other words, he said when the economy is kind of in the doldrums or slumped or something, the government should jump in and spend a bunch of money and kick it back into gear and run big deficits to do it. Well, the conservatives in Congress have been completely against that, and the Obama administration was only half-hearted in doing it, so we kind of got stuck where we weren't Keynesian and we weren't going back to Friedman. We just basically were hanging in the middle. The great irony here is that the Republicans in the Congress and the new president-elect are planning, by all of their rhetoric and all of the promises they're making right now, not during the election, to out-Keynes Keynes. In other words, they want to spend a lot of government money. They want to run up a big deficit initially. They even changed the, I don't know if you know the way the Congressional Budget Office tracks these things. They can run up a big deficit on a bill now, starting this year.
Mm-hmm.
Starting next year, actually. They can run up a big deficit on a bill where there's no taxes to cover it, and they don't have to do a tax cut someplace else if they can present evidence that it will kick enough fire into the economy that they'll get the tax revenue in the future.
This is something that a lot of people talk to me about when the Congressional Budget Office comes up with expected revenue on a tax drop or tax hike, and they say they never get it right. Well, they get it in a range of possibilities. It's harder to track, a lot harder to track, expectations for a change in the economy based on a change in the taxes. You can change the tax and have some ability to say what revenue you expect based on the year before. When you change the tax and it's going to affect the economy and that's where you're going to get the extra revenue, now you're talking the world of virtual fantasy. We don't know what's going to happen out there. And even if we know what happened the year before, it's different every year because the economy is different every year. It's a scary thing to say that our debt is going to be reliant on something that we have absolutely no knowledge of. It's a little more than a little scary. Keynes, by the way, contrary to the politicians, Keynes and Friedman were relatively close together in a whole series of areas. The political economists tend to grab Keynes and say liberal government spending and Friedman as kind of the laissez-faire Jeffersonian stay out of the economy government. neither of those opinions is correct. Keynes believed in lowering taxes and lowering benefits to the citizen in good years. And Friedman believed in the government being the last resort in terms of depressions. So we've taken an extreme version of their views that neither one of them would have agreed upon and made them political. I think that's humanity as a whole. I mean, it's why religions lead to warfare that are generally based in good things, whether it's Christianity, Islam, Hindu, Buddhist, it doesn't matter. We have a tendency of taking an extreme view and saying that that's the real view.
Well, suffice to say that we're very bullish, very optimistic about what's coming. It's going to be change. Change is uncomfortable, but very frankly, we need some change right now. And, you know, there's a couple of things that are kind of scary out there, including the fact that the Russians very clearly were paying companies to produce false news ads to try to get Donald Trump elected.
Well, I don't think it was about Donald Trump. I think it was to call into question the accuracy and the reliability of our entire system.
Yeah, and those are things that need to be addressed.
I don't think that Putin, by the way, favored Trump over Clinton. I think that Putin wanted confusion. If you look at the borders of Russia, if you look at the countries that surround Russia, and you see all the little civil wars that are happening around there, they're being funded on both sides by Russia. Russia thrives when other people are in chaos. So by throwing a question into the race, it may have benefited Trump in the outcome. But I think if Trump comes out of this as the American that he is acting like, he's not going to like the attack on our system. The fact that they're paying people to put fake news out, we have freedom of speech. Anybody can say anything they want. Accepting money from the Russians to say something is completely within the rights of everybody out there. If they paid me to sit down, I have every right to say whatever I want to say, and they can pay me for it. That's what freedom of speech means. If they hacked the actual system, then there's a different line that's been crossed, and one that I think that Trump or anybody else is going to look at and say, that's a line you cannot cross. You can't come in and throw doubt on the very system that we have. Our president, Barack Obama, and our president-elect, Donald Trump, have both said that they stand by the election results. It's still worthwhile to look at them, the same reason why Donald Trump said he may not accept, he'll wait and see what the election results are. We're allowed to do audits on our system to make sure it functions well. The scary piece here is that it looks like a foreign power was tweaking the way our government works. And Trump made a big point of talking about lobbyists not working for foreign powers when they've been part of the executive branch of government. That a lifetime removal of that. And I think that that is something he agrees with us on that about.
Okay, I want to close out with a, you asked me about some numbers earlier and I had to hunt them up. This year, about $500 billion has run out of equity funds and into bonds. Last week, the flows reversed with investors pulling out $18 billion from bonds and pouring $27.5 billion into stocks, which means some of it's coming out of cash. Now, we're nowhere near at the point right now where stocks have gotten as much money back in as flowed out this year, but I kind of suspect the way things are going is things pick up, you will see that reverse very nicely next year. Bonds probably going down very significantly and stocks very much going up, and then we're at the end of our time.
Yes, we are. If you would like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting during the weekend locally at
947-1111.
You can reach that number toll-free, 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly at Jeff@tpwc.com or Jake@tpwc.com.
And you can go to our website, which is www.tpwc.com or thepersonalwealthcoach.com. Read all about us and listen to our podcast, where if your intelligence hasn't been lowered enough, you can do it again.
Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Truth. It's not just a word on your Fox News station. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.